You are listening to Mountain Money on KPCW, broadcasting from Park City, Utah. Good morning. You are listening to KPCW Park City. My name is Allison Kulo, and this is Mountain Money. I'm joined here with my co-host, Roger Goldman. Good morning.
Good morning, Allison. It may be August 31st, but September is definitely in the air. I could hear Earth, Wind, and Fire playing in my head when I went outside this morning and felt the crispness of September upon us. Also saw a few leaves starting to change. Here we go.
Man, I know. I've been seeing the leaves turn as well. So here we are. Welcome to fall. You want to tell us our listeners what we've got today?
Well, we're going to fall into a great show today. Our first guests will be Karen Hurt and David Dye. They'll be talking about their book, Courageous Cultures, How to Build Teams of Micro-Innovators, Problem Solvers, and Customer Advocates. We'll find out what those terms mean, among many other things.
And then we'll be speaking with Ryan Nelson. He's the president of the Utah Employers Council. He's going to help us review best practices that business owners can follow when there's a positive case in the workplace, and how businesses can put in place policies that allow for employees to voice safety concerns.
And we'll finish our show with yet another guest who I wish was in the studio with samples, Casey Metzger, owner of Top Shelf Services. He'll be talking about his business and the changes made to adapt to our current environment, including the development of the Bartender's Box, a top shelf cocktail experience delivered to your door. All this and more today on Mountain Money. We'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Many leaders are convinced that they have an open environment that encourages employees to speak up and are shocked when they learn that employees feel the opposite. Employees have ideas and want to be heard. Leaders want to hear them. Too often, however, employees and leaders both feel that no one cares about making things better. The disconnect typically only widens over time, with both sides becoming more firmly entrenched in their viewpoints. The culprit? Company culture.
Too many C's. Our guests this morning, Karen Hurt and David Dye, conducted research that confirms why organizations struggle when it comes to creating strong cultures where employees are encouraged to contribute their best thinking. They've developed a roadmap to building a high-performance, high-engagement culture around sharing ideas, solving problems, and rewarding contributions from all levels. A courageous culture. In our world of rapid change, a courageous culture is your competitive advantage. It ensures that your company is sticky for both customers and employees. It means building teams of micro-innovators, problem solvers, and customer advocates working together.
Karen Hurt and David Dye join us this morning to talk about their book, Courageous Cultures, How to Build Teams of Micro-Innovators, Problem Solvers, and Customer Advocates. The book contains practical tools to uncover, leverage, and scale the best ideas from every level of your organization. Karen and David, welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you so much for having us.
Good morning.
Well, we're happy to have you. So why don't you take a moment and tell us how this book came to be and why this topic is so essential for leaders of organizations?
As we were working with our clients really around the world across a variety of industries, we were noticing a really interesting pattern. We would go in and work at the very senior levels of organizations, and we would hear frustrated executives saying things like, why am I the only one who finds these issues? Why don't people speak up and share their best ideas? What's wrong with my lower level managers? Why aren't they pulling out the best ideas from their teams? And then we would go into work at the very front line of those very same organizations, and we would hear things like, nobody wants to hear my ideas. You know, the last time I spoke up, I got in trouble. You know, nothing ever happens anyway. I don't know why I bother. And we thought, oh, wow, are you working in the same company? So employees have ideas, and most leaders want to hear them, and somehow there was a disconnect. And so that's why we went in and partnered with the University of North Colorado to really dig in both an extensive quantitative and qualitative study to understand why people are reluctant to share their ideas and what are the organizations that are doing this well and how are they pulling out the best ideas from their employees.
So that's an interesting project. How do you go about doing something like that?
Yeah, so, you know, it really starts with making sure that you are getting very clear about your own narrative around courage, because leaders go first, right? And so if you want to pull out the best ideas from your team, you need to make sure that you are also being confident to speak up and that you are sharing your best practices.
Because the ironic thing is that when you look at a courageous culture, once it's built, the norm is that people like us speak up and we share ideas and we contribute on behalf of the customer and one another. And if everyone's doing that, it actually takes less individual courage. But to build it, the leader, as Karen said, has to go first. And so as you navigate the narrative, then there's some more steps that you'll take to do that. Once you've grounded yourself in your own courage, getting very clear about the idea, how you cultivate curiosity and actually invite those ideas. One of the things that came out in our research is that 49% of respondents said they're not regularly asked for ideas by their leaders. And when you talk to leaders about this, you get a different sense. They say, well, wait a minute. Everybody knows I want ideas. I have an open door. Anybody can bring me anything. And the problem with that is that it's passive and that the best ideas are unlikely to walk through your open door. So as a leader, we invite you and we give you the tools to practically invite and draw out that best thinking from your team.
And then it's really about how do you respond to those ideas that people are bringing to you. So navigating the narrative, getting really clear about your own willingness to speak up, being very clear about where you want an idea and what a good idea would accomplish. Then from there, cultivating curiosity, drawing out the best ideas, and then responding with regard and letting people know what you're doing with those ideas.
You know, I think we want to go a little more into how to accomplish a courageous culture. But first, I'd like to ask you, why do you think it is that the default position or the status quo in so many organizations is not to facilitate that kind of communication? Why do you think that's why companies start from this other position?
Well, there are some natural tendencies in human nature that contribute to this. So it's not that anyone has a bad intent necessarily, but when you get into the research around psychological safety and the work of Dr. Amy Edmondson from Harvard, who wrote our foreword, one of the things that comes up is that people have a natural tendency to overweight past negative experiences. So, and we came across this frequently as we were talking and interviewing folks. We'd hear things like, well, hey, I'm not speaking up. Well, why not? Well, you know, I had this bad experience where I shared an idea and I got in trouble or I got fired or something bad happened. And okay, well, how long ago was that? Oh, it was 10 years ago. Well, was it with this company? Oh, heck no, but I'm never making that mistake again. And so, you know, and we found a number of those examples where people have those kinds of experiences and we overweight the negative experiences paired with a tendency to discount the future. And so what this means is that any individual, we tend to underestimate the positive benefits that will accrue from whatever idea we were to share. And then you pair all of that with there's a natural tendency in many leaders to feel like they're under the gun and have to have all the answers. And it's just a natural thing that comes about where what great leadership looks like, particularly in a courageous culture, is to ask the right questions. The world we live in today is so complex and nuanced, you're never going to have all the answers. And so those three kind of human nature tendencies combine to produce some cultures where silence is the safe default. But the price of that is that you have so many micro innovations, solutions, ways of better serving customers, ways of improving processes. It's interesting, when we did the research, we said, hey, if you have an idea to share, what would it do? And the top three answers, it wasn't things like, kombucha on tap or, you know, or let's improve our break room. It wasn't those sorts of things. It was ideas that would improve the productivity of the organization, that would make employees more efficient, or it would improve customer service or customer outcomes, things that go directly to the bottom line of organizations. And so those tendencies, those natural defaults are things that leaders really want to be actively working to overcome.
So as you mentioned, there is that past hesitation that people have, and sometimes it's not even a situation where they were shot down, but maybe someone during a meeting that it happened to someone else and they don't want that to happen to them. But people have so much they can bring to the organization. You talk about in your book kind of three types of people. You have innovators, problem solvers, and customer advocates. Can you detail those out for us?
Yeah, so a micro innovator is when you talk about building micro innovators, that is encouraging every employee at every level of the organization to think strategically about the work that they are doing. And what are the small enhancements that could add up to really improve the business? So, you know, we're not talking about these really big, you know, let's take change the an idea to change the strategic direction of your organization. We're saying teaching people to, if something feels stupid, to speak up and say, you know what, I have a better way. Or to look at a process and say, I know a way to make this more efficient. And that you're teaching your teams to think critically about the work that they're doing every day. So that's a micro innovator. A customer advocate is how do you get people to think on behalf of the customer, to really put themselves in the perspective of the customer and think and bring ideas that would help to create a better customer experience. And then a problem solver is how do you get people to really think about what are the big hairy issues that are driving them crazy and to proactively offer their best thinking to improve those.
In terms of, I guess one of the questions I had was, how do you identify and facilitate those kinds of personalities? And I guess more importantly, you know, as a manager, how do I change the culture to really open the door for openness? One of the things you talked about was being proactive. Can you give us an example of how a CEO or a senior manager could open the door, if you will, by being proactive in terms of seeking out the kind of input you're talking about?
Absolutely. So one of the techniques that we utilize or invite leaders to use is when they're cultivating curiosity is what we call a courageous question. And a courageous question differs from just a kind of a lame generic, hey, how can we improve? Bring me your ideas. It's different because it's specific and it's vulnerable. It targets a very specific issue. And the vulnerability is that in the question, it assumes improvement is possible, and that makes it safe for people to answer. So let's give you some examples of what we mean here. So if somebody says, like this is a real example from the chief operating officer at a contact center that we worked with, and he liked to ask his people, what is one of our policies that really sucks? And so you're asking frontline customer-facing people that question. They're hearing every day about the policies that are irritating and frustrating customers. So they can raise their hand and say, well, here's one that I'm hearing quite a bit. And he would follow up and say, okay, great. Well, it's specific. What is a policy and where is it irritating or frustrating our customers? You know, another question that leaders might ask right now, what is one way that we can better facilitate racial equity in our organization? That's specific and it's vulnerable because it assumes improvement is possible and it makes it safe to actually answer. Now, how you respond matters, but that's the starting place, is to ask courageous questions. So those are a couple of examples there.
Yeah, and then another way is to help your team think through how to bring you better ideas. So first of all, one of the things that we really found is that if you can be very specific, A, about two things. One, that you really want people's ideas, but two, where you both need a great idea. And then teach your people how to think through these ideas in a critical way. So we have a model that we teach in our training programs called the IDEA model. And it stands for I, why is this idea interesting? Meaning, how is it strategically aligned with where we're headed as a business or where we've said we need a great idea? D, is it doable? Meaning, is this something we could pull off right now? Because right now, in the middle of all of this fast pivot and the stress and strain that everyone is going through, you know, we're looking for ideas that we could actually pull off. E, is it engaging? Meaning, who else would think this is a great idea? This is where you're thinking, teaching your people to think about who are the stakeholders and how do they draw people in to think critically about ideas. And then A, what would you recommend are a couple of key next steps? Because a lot of the time, so key actions. So I think one of the things that is a challenge sometimes is that it's not that people aren't getting any ideas. They're getting so many ideas, and they're not well thought through, and they're maybe a little bit half-baked, and managers shut down because they're like, no, forget it. I don't have time for this innovation. But if you can help your team to think more critically using this IDEA model to screen, when they present their ideas to you, they're more likely to be something that is well vetted for you and something you could do something with.
So your book explores these best practices. Can you give us an example of a company, just kind of taking us through that process they went through and being able to open up more?
Sure. Several different examples come to mind. So one quick one, we talked with Jason Fried, co-founder of Basecamp, and he said, you know, if you want people thinking creatively and solving problems and identifying those opportunities to improve the business, that requires space to think. The alternative is wall-to-wall meetings, which is the default for many organizations, particularly if you're working remotely. And so they are very intentional at Basecamp about carving out and protecting that thinking time and giving people margin in which their brains can naturally reflect. Another great example is something we came across at WellSpan Health that we refer to as the patient perspective. But the way this works is in any high-level strategic meeting where they're really doing some deep thinking, problem solving, or starting a new initiative, one person in that meeting has the responsibility to only act as the patient, in the role of the patient. So in other words, if you're normally the IT director and it's your job to be the patient in that meeting, somebody else fills in the IT role and you're going to serve as the patient. And so the way this practically worked out was they were implementing a new scheduling system because it was a frequent problem that, say, rehab would show up to do the rehabilitation work with a patient, but that patient was off being tested or getting blood drawn or some other problem. And so, you know, you come up with a scheduling system that's going to prevent those kinds of miscues. Well, in the course of the discussion, the person playing the role of the patient raised their hand and said, I'd like to know my schedule too. And everybody else in the meeting winced and went, oh, that's going to be hard because we're a hospital, right? And if the patient's relying on that schedule, it's not going to be dependable. And he said, no, I get it. I know it's a hospital. I know things are difficult and there's challenges and changes that are going to happen. But even if it's 80% correct, listen, I have cancer. I'm already feeling out of control of my life. And if 80% of the time it's accurate when I can tell my family to visit or I can know when different things are going to be done so they don't show up and spend time there, that's going to help me feel more in control. So they implemented this new scheduling process, including the patient notification component of it, and saw their patient satisfaction scores rise significantly. Those are two quick examples.
And what I like about those stories is just as you sort of posited that I have an open door is far less effective than tell me a specific practice that you'd like to see that would enhance racial equity. The way you went from a broad, tell me what you want on your mind, to a here's a specific I want to explore, so too that kind of an example really helps, I think, us recognize how a culture that facilitates those kinds of questions can have, you know, an enhanced performance. One of the things we've seen during the pandemic is that many organizations have faced unique challenges, and yet we've seen a wide variance in how creative their responses to that challenge have been. Can you give us any examples that you've observed about how creative companies have met that challenge by innovative practices?
Yeah, so everyone is right on this past pivot to do the best they can with what they have from where they are. And we have been working with a variety of organizations, some very big and some fast growing, that on using the Courageous Cultures techniques to help draw out people's ideas. So I'll give you an example of some work that we did just last week. We were working with Lily's Sweets, which is a fast growing healthy candy company. And, you know, we went in and very quickly, everybody read the book, and then we quickly just covered some of the basic tools. And then in a 75-minute session, we took their five strategic initiatives that really matter for the company right now, and we broke into breakout rooms virtually and had people using the tools to come up with their very best ideas. And it was fascinating how quickly they could get into real solutions and best ideas to, you know, some of them were marketing ideas, some of them were sales ideas, some of them were employee engagement ideas, very, very quickly to pull all that together.
So you're saying that reading the book and through a 75-minute session, you were able to take a company who may not have lived by this philosophy of creative cultures and seeking input, you were able to turn them around in some ways within 75 minutes to help them.
Well, I would say for this company in particular, they already had what I would describe as a courageous culture, so they were very open to doing that. So this was really giving them some structure to build on their plan.
And if you're starting in an organization, let's say you're a senior leader and looking at your organization saying, you know, we have not been as open or as inviting in this way. Okay, great. That self-awareness is a great place to start. Where we recommend you start and the way that we wrote Courageous Cultures for any leader that wants to transform their culture is to start with your team. You will find in the book a series of questions and an accompanying executive strategy guide that will help guide you and your team through the process of building that culture for yourself first and then inviting the larger organization into it. So if you're leading a 100-person department, you can start with your immediate leadership team. If you're leading a very large company, you can start with your immediate leadership team. If you're a 5-person team, you can start there and say, how do we do this for our team?
Yeah, and at the end of each chapter of the book, it guides you through a very practical process. And then you can also download a free executive strategy guide, which is a fillable PDF, so you can pull as you build your strategy working with your team along the way.
And by the way, that is one of the interesting things about this book, is it is not just the theoretical. I think you guys have done a really excellent job at not only putting out concepts for executives to use, but sort of guides and tools to help actually implement those concepts in a meaningful and strategic way. One of the questions I did have, though, was that you talk about the concept of a sticky culture, or a sticky corporation, rather. Talk to us a little bit about sticky and what does it mean?
Absolutely. Well, basically, with stickiness, we're talking about both retaining customers and retaining employees. And so, you know, when you talk about employees, some of the other research that came up, we have 50% of employees said that if I share an idea, it's not going to be taken seriously. And this is at every level. We talked to vice presidents who said, yeah, I shared some ideas. They said, I'm not paying you for your ideas. Just do your work. Well, they're retiring on the clock, right? And so, or they're just sometimes leaving and going someplace where their ideas do matter. So stickiness is about demonstrating that value to your employees, that not only that they're there, that their work is valuable, but the thinking that they can do differentiates you from any other organization, because, you know, the future of work, and particularly as we're now, everybody is experienced that can experience it, has experienced remote work, that decreases the friction of shifting jobs. So as the economy comes back and so forth, you're competing against the entire job market. And so the more that your employees feel that they're making a difference, that their ideas are valued, and that they're contributing to the organization's success at a larger level, the more they're going to want to stay.
And from a customer perspective, sticky means if you know that you've got employees at every level of the business thinking about and on behalf of the customer, you are going to be providing a better, best-in-class customer experience, and then your customers are way more likely to want to work with you rather than some competitor who is not advocating for them.
I'd like to ask one more question before we have to go, and that is, do you have any specific observations on how the sort of current environment where we have so much so much virtual corporate interaction and so many things are no longer in person. Any specific thoughts on how that affects the ability to create this kind of culture?
You know, it's a very interesting question that you asked there, because we have for the last 5 months been running program after program using the Courageous Cultures tools with companies, and every single one of these programs has been virtual, right? And so what we're finding is everything that you would have to do to create a courageous culture when you're in the office, you have to do on steroids when you are remote. So you have to be even more deliberate about clarity, communicating where you need an idea, where the strategic direction is happening. We talk about communicating anything that's really important in terms of your strategy 5 times 5 different ways. So that one of the things we've been really working with a lot of companies around is how do they build a more creative communication strategy, not just relying on Zoom or Microsoft team meetings, not just relying on email, but really tapping into more creative ways to get people engaged and involved in contributing.
And in that note, the one thing that we have heard from every executive we have worked with over the last 5 months is that courageous cultures are more important now than they ever have been before, because you need ideas at every level of the organization to help your business to work and to deliver value to customers in new and different ways.
Yeah, because nobody has written the book on how to lead well during a pandemic, right? Everyone is learning as they go here. And so, you know, imagine you have two managers. One manager says, you know, I know what we're going to do. Here's how we're going to approach this. This is how we're going to transition to working from home. And another manager says, you know what? I know we can get through this, shows up with confidence, but you know, I don't have all the answers. How do you think we can be most productive and effective in this environment? And taps into every idea of every employee in their organization. Which organization is going to have the greater competitive advantage, right? It's the one that's tapping into the more hearts and minds.
We've been talking to Karen Hurt and David Dye, authors of Courageous Cultures, How to Build Teams of Micro-Innovators, Problem Solvers, and Customer Advocates. Thank you for joining us. Mountain Money will be right back after this.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. This year, the area of human resources has become more critical than ever. From remote working policies, layoffs, furloughs, mental health needs of employees, and the childcare crisis parents are facing, there's no shortage of topics we could cover here. But today, we're going to talk about having a COVID case in the workplace. And so a COVID case in the workplace can bring this busy workforce to a standstill. What are the requirements that employers have to alert employees when a coworker has fallen ill? How can employers balance their obligation to protect private and confidential health information, all while working to allow open discussions of COVID issues? Ryan Nelson is the president of the Utah Employers Council. It's a membership-based organization that assists businesses with legal and HR experience and expertise in every facet of human resources and employment law. Ryan joins us today to help us understand what best practices business owners can follow when there is a positive case in the workplace and how businesses can put in place policies that allow for safety concerns to be voiced by employees. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the basics. You know, despite every safety precaution that a business can take or an employer could take, employees can still contract the virus. What steps are businesses required to take to notify and quarantine other employees when there's a COVID case in the workplace? And are there any differences in like county to county for regulations like this?
Yeah, let me start with that last question first. The differences in state and county obligations. So the state health department has put out guidance that all employers have to follow. The counties, depending on the circumstances within the boundaries of the county, could have more stringent requirements. So you have both of those to consider. Think of the state as the floor, and counties can go above that and have more stringent requirements. So looking at an employer who becomes aware that one of their employees has contracted COVID or perhaps is symptomatic, The employer needs to do a couple things. First, if the employee is in the workplace, get that person secluded and quickly with the goal of getting them out of the workplace. Once they have the employee quarantined, they need to do what's called contact tracing. And a simple rule to remember about contact tracing is what we're trying to avoid or to limit is the spread of the virus. So we're looking at what we call close contact. Close contact is anyone who was within 6 feet for 15 minutes or more within the previous 48 hours of symptoms manifesting or a positive test of this employee. So 6, 15, 24. The employers are then asking the person who's tested positive, who were you in close contact with? And when they have that list, they're notifying those employees individually that they were potentially exposed to someone who has tested positive or has been symptomatic, and that they also now need to quarantine themselves. And so the employer would send those individuals, additional employees, out of the workforce back home where they quarantine for a 14-day period.
Are we finding that there is widespread compliance with those requirements here in Utah?
Great question. And I would say yes, but at the same time, I would say no. And I think the difficulty there in compliance is when you think of the CDC and the Utah Department of Health and every other email or other organization that's trying to circulate and share information, it's just an overwhelming flow of content. So it's difficult to disseminate down to exactly what it is we're supposed to do and when and how it applies. And then you add on top of that the counties and individual county orders and how they may differ. It's an overwhelming flow of information. So companies need help. They need to get resources and expert support to navigate through this. I will say that the state of Utah did publish a business guide a month or so ago, which is really quite useful and has factual scenarios and explanations that align with the CDC, but are explained in a much more clear and simple way so that employers can implement and follow the guidance.
By the way, I thought the explanation you just gave was very clear. Are there resources currently available where an employer who, for example, might be listening to this program and is unclear about one element or another, is there an easy way, a hotline they can call to get questions answered that you're aware of?
A hotline, no. Outside of reaching out to a paid consultant or a law firm or an attorney, no. But I will say, though, again, the CDC page has, or the CDC website has excellent resources to cover general employer responsibilities, but also industry-specific distinctions based on healthcare, for example, or manufacturing or restaurant. These additional responsibilities applicable to an industry are spelled out with recommendations and guidance. The second one is that Utah Department of Health business guide. It's accessible on the Utah COVID page. I recommend employers find, access, and review those.
Good. Thank you.
So nationally, there are many cases where workers say their bosses have cited employee privacy when telling them not to share information, whether it's among fellow employees or even on social media, about COVID cases in their workplace. To justify these gags, many companies are citing federal privacy laws, such as the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act of 1996. Do these laws allow companies to silence employees on safety matters?
Generally, no. And let me explain with HIPAA to begin with. Now, HIPAA applies to covered entities that receive protected health information. Now, generally speaking, and in most instances, when an employer receives medical information about an employee, it is not HIPAA protected unless it's done so in the context of, like, benefit enrollment, for example. That would be HIPAA protected information. But when an employee tests positive and informs me, the employer, that I have a positive test, that's not going to be HIPAA protected because the employer is not receiving that information as a covered entity under HIPAA. However, there are other federal laws that do cover that. So the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, what it says is when we have medical information, when we, the employer, obtain this from employees, we have an obligation to keep it confidential. Now, confidential does not mean secret. It means share it with those who absolutely have a legitimate reason to know. And generally, that's going to be a very small circle when it comes to a COVID case. So to say that HIPAA precludes employees from talking about these types of issues in the workplace, I would say no. There is, of course, a confidentiality obligation, and employers should be cognizant of that and explaining to their employees, for example, we had a positive COVID test, and of course, every employee is going to ask, well, who was it? And the employer's response is, well, we can't tell you that. It's confidential. And anyone within that circle who now knows who that person is under that same obligation to maintain that information confidential. Now, there's a couple other areas, though, that an employer needs to be aware of. OSHA, for example. OSHA gives me, the employee, the right to complain about unsafe working conditions. So if I feel, or perceive that my employer is not taking appropriate actions to create and maintain a safe working environment, then I have the right to speak up. And I have the right to engage OSHA or UOSH here in the state and let them know that I have a concern. I also have the right to talk to my employer and share my concerns about the work environment. There's one other federal law that is less known and understood in this area, and it's the National Labor Relations Act. Now, we think NLRA and we think unions, but the NLRA is also broad enough to cover non-union work environments as it relates to protected and concerted activity by employees. So protected concerted activity is simply stated, it's the right that employees have to act together to address work-related issues. For example, talking about my wages or benefits or working conditions, or even talking about or refusing to work in an unsafe work condition. So if employers are limiting or preventing employees from talking with each other about unsafe work conditions, they potentially could also run afoul of the National Labor Relations Act.
You know, as a recovering attorney, I have a strong suspicion that we're going to see litigation over the workplace issues surrounding COVID for years after this. And one of the questions I had as I was listening to you just now was, let's assume for the moment that I have contact tracing, and as a result of contact tracing, other employees are almost by definition going to be made aware of the identity of a covered person. What happens if they start talking about that within the workplace? Can they be disciplined for that? Does that fall within confidentiality? I think those kinds of questions are very real and are going to create a lot of tension between employees and employers. Have we seen anything like that so far?
Yeah, great question. The lawsuits are just starting to trickle out. I've not seen a confidentiality / discipline case that's been alleged where, for example, the employer terminated the employee for sharing confidential information when they shouldn't have, and the employer alleged that that was a wrongful termination. I've not seen something like that, although I agree. I think those are certainly on the litigation menu of what's to come. The challenge, I think, for the employer, this is a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. You have to maintain confidentiality, but at the same time, you have to manage the workforce, you have to manage the employees, you have to continue to produce and do business, whatever that is. And that's a very, very difficult balance. And there will be errors. There will be mistakes that employers make. So if we have employees who become aware of, just by deduction, let's say, we figured out that the only person who's not here is John, and it just happens to be that the company announced that we had an employee test positive and he's out. Well, everyone knows this, that's John. The fact that we've deduced that as employees and we talk about that with each other, I wouldn't say that that's confidential information. The company didn't share that. We were careful to not identify the individual. But if employees deduce that, I don't think there's much that an employer could do to prevent that. And by the same extension then, and reasoning, I wouldn't discipline because of that either. If employees just figure it out and talk about it, why would we discipline for that? If again, no one's done anything wrong per se, we're just talking about something that's part of the workplace. So employers, in my opinion, need to tread carefully in disciplining to ensure that we're not just reacting because something happens that we don't like, but rather if we do discipline, we're doing so because there's a concern. It's safety, it's confidentiality, it's workforce or workplace standards, it's productivity. We're focusing on those key elements, not just, we didn't like that. That would makes me a little uneasy.
So to focus our last few minutes on another portion of this topic, I wanted to just ask from you, one, I know that OSHA is unable to keep up with the thousands of complaints about pandemic-related safety issues that have been coming in. So can you just either give us the advice that you have for employees who have safety concerns, as well as with regards to an employer, what can they put in place as far as a whistleblower policy to give that employee some more comfort?
Yeah, let me start with what the employer should put into place. first and foremost, they need to have a functional and effective complaint process that the employees can use and actually works. When a complaint is raised, the employer promptly and thoroughly responds to the complaint. And prompt and thorough, just do what you say you're going to do, look at the issue objectively, and make a decision that's based on what your investigation reveals. And if you've made a mistake or it's an unsafe condition, address it and move on. I would also advise employers to implement training to ensure that managers and supervisors understand the complaint process, but also, and most importantly, that they understand the retaliation protections that arise when an employee invokes the complaint process. Now, generally speaking, retaliation protects employees and their right to complain, not to be correct about the complaint. So we don't want to chill or interfere with that complaint mechanism. So retaliation is there to ensure that the employee can bring those concerns, even if they might be wrong. And then managers and supervisors are the front line of defense for an employer in managing that. They have to be the eyes and the ears and watching the workforce, and especially those who have raised complaints. Be sure that we're not treating them differently because we didn't like what they said or we didn't like that they complained. That's their right, and they can do that. So when a manager or supervisor takes an adverse employment decision against an individual who's made a complaint, my advice to them and the questions that we typically focus on are to be very sure and comfortable that the complaint has nothing to do with why we're talking discipline now. That it's because of performance, it's because of a violation of standards, whatever that may be. Now, for employees, I don't advise employees, so this is just general statement here, but for employees, understand that the posters that you have on the wall in your employment place of employment define what your rights are. If OSHA is not able to keep up, that doesn't mean you still can't raise your concern with the agency. They'll get to it. It may take a little more time, but they will get to it. I would add, though, also that employees be courageous and communicate with your employers about your concerns. And employers, be open and receptive to that communication from your employees. I think so many of these types of administrative complaints and litigation can be resolved up front if people will sit down and simply just communicate effectively, express the concern, deal with it, figure out a way they'll move forward. We can avoid the administrative concerns, I think, in many instances, if we simply just effectively communicate. So that's what I would share for both employers and employees.
Ryan, you're with the Utah Employers Council. Can you give us your 20-second elevator pitch as far as what you guys do?
Absolutely. We are, as you said, a membership organization. Our goal is to support employers with legal advice, legal representation, and also data and metrics. We want employers to know and understand their obligations. We want them to proactively address concerns and to have the pieces in the right places before a complaint or before something blows up. You need good counsel, you need expert advice, and that's what we're here for.
Thank you, Ryan. We've been speaking with Ryan Nelson. He's the president of the Utah Employers Council. Mountain Money, we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Our next guest is Casey Metzger with Top Shelf Professional Bar Services. Top Shelf Professional Bar Services has been providing unparalleled bartending and consulting services to Utah and the surrounding states for over a decade. The business provides services for all types of events, including fundraisers, festivals, corporate retreats, house parties, weddings, and more. Essentially, they do things for most everything that is not permitted to take place during COVID. Casey, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Roger, for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about the challenges that you faced during this pandemic and some of the ways in which you're trying to meet them.
Yeah, so as the COVID-19 pandemic set in, it became very clear to us and everybody in our industry, wedding planners, caterers, and such, that things are going to change, and they're going to change very drastically. There's a big lead time associated with events. And so, you know, when it hit, a lot of what we were gearing up for down the road, 3, 4, 6 months out, was really showing, we were seeing signs that it was going to be a lot different. So, you know, our industry has been completely derailed. But that being said, you know, we've just been really hard at work trying to understand, you know, the impacts of how our industry and our businesses is going to take it, and try to get creative and stay involved as much as possible in our industry and as well as in the community, just to keep our finger on the pulse and being helpful wherever we see we can. And I think that's going to help us. That would help us as a business as an individual business to bear the storm.
I think, you know, some of the roles that you have in the community help you kind of keep the pulse a little bit better than others. You're the chair of the Park City Chamber and Visitors Bureau Board, and you also sit on the Chamber's Economic Resiliency Committee. So what types of information are you starting to hear with regard to that role in the outlook for businesses in the future?
Well, thanks, Allison. That's a really good question, and I've been thinking about that a lot lately. You know, as I got my volunteerism, as I got more involved with the chamber and then was asked to be the chair, you know, it's a lot of work. And I was really excited to be able to serve that organization. It's an amazing organization that I think is showing how much value. I don't know if everybody realizes what a chamber of commerce really can do for a business community. And I've been able to see that up front and personal over the last couple of years. And I think now there's going to be a lot of value that people start to see that maybe they perhaps didn't see before. I know as a small business in Park City, which there's a lot of us, the chamber has been very important in communicating resources that we all may or may not know that are out there. You know, there's a lot of resources and funding opportunities, consulting and just overall advice that the business community should be aware of. And the membership side of the chamber has been doing a stellar job at doing that. It's a ton of information. It's changing every day. And the department at the chamber that is responsible for the membership and communications and whatnot it's really, really good work. And so my volunteerism has really helped my business because I've been paying attention and trying to aid in that effort. And being that close to that information, I think, has been an advantage, really, for us to understand what this might look like. You know, it's always changing. And I always say, you know, we're trying to build a plane as it's going up in the air, putting wings and wings on and windows in as we're trying to forecast what the next 3 months are going to look like. But it has everything to do with the information that I'm trying to gather in helping the chamber and the task force and committees that I'm on. But at the end of the day, it's really giving us a little framework to work within and understand what the runway looks like for us as a small business.
Casey, we want to get to questions about the incredibly creative Bartender's Box, but one last question on the chamber. Are there specific things the chamber is looking for from either state, local, or even federal government? Any specific programs that you're pushing for at this point?
I think first and foremost, the leadership team at the chamber is paying attention to safety, and I think that the narrative has been about safety first, and we all want to get back to business. But we realize that if we don't do it in the right way, that we're going to be in trouble if it's not done the right way. And I think that there was some very aggressive moves at the very beginning, but I think that everybody's seen that it's paid off to a certain degree. And so I think that the chamber has been working very closely in all different sectors or departments within the chamber in their own spaces to understand safety first and then and that's, you know, that starts with the leadership at the state level and then to the county level. And then as a chamber, as an organization to help spread that information. One thing I've been truly amazed at with all the time that I've been putting in over the last 6 months or whatnot is how much the Chamber Bureau, the city, the county, and the state and offices within all of those different organizations work together. It's pretty amazing. And you know, as a business guy, it's been really nice to see that how much our local municipality and state level governments have really championed the small business and really what it means to our communities and the people that live within them. Because at the end of the day, you know, we all have a job, and that's what makes the community kind of go around.
So we have just a few minutes left. I want to talk with you about the bartender's box. This was something that you did not have in place pre-COVID. Why don't you tell our listeners what it is and where they can find
sure.
it?
Sure. Sure. Thank you. I'd love to be able to talk a little bit about that. The you know, during this downtime, you know, we as a team started, you know, we're assessing what's really going to happen to our business and trying to imagine possible scenarios of what it looks like for us moving forward. And the management team, we use that time to, you know, not only to take care of the business, but to dig into the details of what that might look like and to think out of the box, really. And what we ended up doing is using that time and the resources that we were able to put our hands on to pour our creativity and our passion for helping our clients entertain into a box. And we came up with the idea of the bartender's box. It's a fresh, fun, and easy cocktailing experience for people to entertain in smaller groups, really. You know, we came up with a bunch of different ideas. We came up with the smallest bar in Utah, which is a private event space that we converted from an office. And then we did the bartender's box and then specialized in COVID-safe events that are smaller in numbers. So the bartender's box was probably the most exciting one. It's a fresh, fun, and easy cocktailing experience that you can order at thebartendersbox.com. We have a menu that you can choose a cocktail from. You know, this is what we love. This is what we do, and we want to bring the passion of our craft and maybe teach a little bit to people and let them understand what it's like to be a bartender. So you pick a cocktail or two. It shows up at your front door. And it comes in the box. It's fresh pressed juices and squeezed juices, homemade syrups. We have instructions from our seasoned professional staff on how to make the cocktails. And there's even some videos of us giving a little bit tips and tricks of the trade that help people be the entertainer, right? And maybe, you know, it's all about getting together and sharing time. You know, we still have to socialize. And we're doing so in small bubbles, right? So everybody's back deck is like the place to be. And the bartender's box, whether it's on the back deck, in an office, or on Zoom calls, this is a great way to socialize, to have fun, to inspire people to in the craft of cocktailing and maybe expand their tasting and things like that.
Casey, we appreciate that, and we also wanted to thank you for sponsoring the Eats Hour of our pledge drive. We've been talking to Casey Metzger of Top Shelf Professional Bar Services.
You've been listening to Mountain Money, broadcast on KPCW, Park City, Utah. For more information, please visit kpcw.org. Please take a moment and give us a rating on your podcast app.